Good day, everybody. Welcome to Dr. Hugh Ross's Paradox class. It's always so much fun to be here. I want to welcome you all, especially live and in person, because we get food back there. And what's more fun than going to church and eating food? Okay. It's good. If you partake of food at the treats table, please think about bringing food to the treats table when on Sundays for everybody else. So thank you. Hugh Ross is on the road, but next week he will be back with us, and he will be with us all the way through like sometime in July. So we have Dave Sargent with us again this morning. This afternoon he's going to talk about Hugh's book, Weathering Climate Change. I'll give you a brief bio of Dave that Mark handed me that's in such tiny print, it's going to completely blow my, you know, cool being up here, but here I go, all right? I even have to take my glasses off to read this. It says, Dave, thanks for this, Mark. Dave's been a student of Hugh Ross for 38 years and worked for JPL for 4 years working on the Viking mission and the mission to Mars on Voyager, and he's been married to Barbara for 36 years. That's the most important fact about him. And he first attended Paradox in 1984. And we're really looking forward to hearing from him. Remember, put on your calendar, June 16th, Hugh Ross is doing the sermon, in both sermons in church. Then he's going to be teaching here three times in one day. And then the next week, June 23rd, he's going to start a five-week series here in Paradox. For us, it'll just seem like more Hugh Ross, which is always wonderful. But hopefully, there will be people attending from the church. We're trying to reintegrate Paradox class with more with Christ Church. So, hope you're here. Please pray for that goes well. Let's see. Dave's got the book table over there. If there's particular Hugh Ross books you want, Dave can probably get a hold of them. And if you've never read any of Hugh Ross's books, I highly recommend it. You've got to take a lot of coffee and really think about it and focus on it, but it is totally worth it. So let's say a prayer and we'll get to Dave and this beautiful day. Heavenly Father, we're so grateful for this class where we can come and worship freely and think about, in an intellectual way, you and your life of love that you give us, Lord. And we pray that what we learn in this class never just stays in our head, but comes through our heart and out in the way that we can witness to people and love the world around us, which is your main mandate that you've given us. Pray for Hugh Ross this morning, wherever he is, and for him teaching wherever he is, and this week, Lord, with him at Reasons to Believe. Please bless Dave as he teaches us this morning, and each one of us as we go our way this afternoon. Thank you. In Jesus' name, amen. Please welcome Dave Sargent.
Okay, let me just get some power to my computer and I will be ready. All right. So I call this an overview or Reader's Digest version of Hugh's book, Weathering Climate Change. A really great book. I'm really happy to say that even before Hugh wrote this book, a lot of people knew that I worked at JPL and that I'd been studying earth sciences pretty much my whole life. It was just my favorite subject at school, and asked me for my opinion on climate change. And so I did my own research before Hugh wrote his own book. And I'm really happy to say that my conclusions were pretty much the same as Hugh's, my conclusions lacked all the formulas and footnotes at the bottom and things or whatever. So I'm going to share what's in the book, and then my last few slides are things that are not in Hugh's book that I found on my own. but we're going to do a look at Hugh's book. Hugh did an in-depth study on ice ages in Paradox class a few years ago before he wrote this book as he was researching it, but I don't think, to my knowledge, did a whole overview of the whole book, so he really only gave us a couple chapters, so we're going to look at the whole book. So, of course, it's a very hot debate now in circles. If you want to ruin your Thanksgiving dinner, bring up climate change, you know. It's very debated, very political, very contentious. There are people all the way on the panic side, obviously, gluing themselves to freeways, and all the way to the people that believe it's not flow at all. And so we want to get rid of the emotions and look and see what's there. When the Bible says, you know, the truth will set you free, it was definitely talking about spiritual matters, but it really applies to everything in life. You know, if you don't know what the problem is, you can't come up with a solution, right? Or if your assumptions are wrong, you can't solve any problem. So we need to find out what is the truth. And Hugh dug into this for years to write this book, to find out what the truth is, and then also to look at the biblical solution, right? So the Bible is not a book just on one topic. It addresses all of humanity and answers questions for all of that. And so we want to look at what is the Christian response, the truth will set us free. And right now, the truth is kind of hard to find because it's so emotionally charged discussion and politically discharged discussion. A little bit of background is before we had climate change word, if you remember back in the 70s, it was global cooling and the next ice age is coming, and that was the big panic. And that was because the mean temperature of the planet cooled between 1965 and 75. And this is a little map up above showing us what the global temperature was during that time period, and you can see it's more blue than this is the current map, which is definitely more reddish and orange. In the 80s, the planet started to warm up, that cooling period went away, and so by 1988, the word global warming was in the scientific literature and the political circles, and some people then started to say we are in a climate emergency. Some people made predictions, and of course this is long enough ago to know that a lot of their predictions didn't come true, which has led some to say that it's totally false. So what's the truth? By 2008, the word climate change, global warming had disappeared from the scientific literature and the political realm, and it became climate change. And that was kind of the fact that some of these, it got them out of a corner. The people that had painted themselves in the corners with some of these predictions of doom and gloom didn't come true. And that way, if anything happens different, right, if there's a hurricane or a tornado, you can say climate change. Doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't have to be warming anymore. It can just be anything. You can say climate change. Unfortunately, for the people that are promoting this, obviously, they really hurt their cause more than they do benefit their cause by making these predictions that don't come true and changing terminology. But again, what's the truth? A lot of people know this one. Al Gore came out with his movie in 06, An Inconvenient Truth. I don't know if he was saying it in tongue-in-cheek, but his proposed title for this book was A Convenient Truth. I don't know if that was serious or whether he does it in tongue-in-cheek, but he thought from a biblical perspective, if there's a problem, there should be a biblical response that's going to be a win-win. Al Gore's plan, reduce the world population, transfer the first world's wealth to second world wealth, which is what we're doing, and to end fossil fuels. And that was his prediction. And if we don't do that, you know, by now, 24, obviously the planet would be doomed. So a lot of his predictions didn't come true. But again, what's the truth? And nobody really likes his plans, obviously, here. So why all the confusion? To start with, obviously, global temperature of the planet is very complex. Ants and viruses are actually a part of global temperature of the planet. But there's lots of other things that affect that. And so that's one of the reasons that the predictions obviously haven't come true, because if somebody just focuses on carbon, they're really missing it, the whole big picture. And a lot of scientists and a lot of the people in the political realm just talk about carbon, 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 and that's not the problem. It's not going to be just the solution. And why is that, obviously? The temperature of the planet is also affected by ocean temperatures. Oceans store heat and release heat. It's one of the reasons that we have our nice Pacific Ocean gives us more temperatures out here. Ocean currents, the solidity of the ocean, snow ice levels, Earth's tilt, Earth's rotation, cloud cover, plants, methane levels, the reflectivity of the total planet, and as I mentioned, even ants and viruses affect the temperature of the planet. So it's very, very complex, and anyone, again, that just focuses just on carbon is really, I know they just don't know the big picture, and it's usually emotional. So what is the data? So if we look at all the data, and we look at the, we have good measurements for, say, the last, 120 years, we can actually see that the global temperature, when we take all the temperatures, average them all out, have risen 1°C or 1.8 Fahrenheit. And so, of course, the question is this man-made? Is it natural? Is it a combination of both? And what is the solution? And that's what Hugh's book addresses. Hugh has several chapters here on ice ages. So it's like anything, obviously, if you're going to look in the future, the first thing you need to do is always look at the past, right? And see what the history of the global temperature of Earth has been. And so Hugh dedicates several chapters in his book into looking at the history of planet Earth's history. And we know for the last, say, 800,000 years, there have been ice ages that happen about every 100,000 years. The last ice age was very severe and very deep. We know that Yosemite was under 4,000 feet of ice, which carved out that beautiful valley. And during that time period is also when God created humanity. And that last ice age being very deep and long is we're actually still benefiting from the melting ice from that ice age that has given us the ability to have global a high population in the billions and also global technology. Earth is also very blessed that our atmosphere has been protected by Earth's magnetic field. And so I made this claim last week, and I was asked to clarify it, and I a little bit. I said that Earth is the largest stable magnet in the universe, and I still hold by that claim. I actually did some more research to verify that I didn't say anything false. The question was, obviously, is the gas giants have magnetic fields also? Jupiter has one, but it's anything but stable. If you had a compass on Jupiter, it'd be wiggling all over the place because the magnetic field is not stable. It's spinning very rapidly, and rather than protecting its moons, like our Earth protects the moon, which is why the astronauts go to the moon, the magnetic field of Jupiter is actually destroying its moons. We have studied 20 million different stars. And most of those don't have planets. The very few that have planets don't have any thing like a solar system like we have. Usually gas giants will form far away and then immediately migrate close to the to their star and just wipe out the planets like Earth and the asteroid belts. So we're very blessed to have this large, very stable magnet to protect our atmosphere that's given us a stable climate not only for thousands of years, but billions of years. Here's a graph of the last 450,000 years, and you can see our ice ages here. The temperature will rise and peak, and then after that peak, we'll immediately go into an ice age where the temperature fluctuates quite a bit. So most of Earth's history is ice ages where the temperature varies a whole bunch. At the very last end of this, you can see a little flat spot, and that's where we're at, and we're going to zoom in and take a look at that. But these are these ice ages, and then you can see this last ice age I talked about where it was very deep and very long. So I jumped ahead on slides. We talked about that already. We've studied 20 million different stars. Most of the stars, like our sun, are in binary systems. Only about half the stars, like our sun, are a solitary one, so that eliminates like half the stars right there. And then of that, our catalog of 20 million stars, we have not found one like our sun that is super stable. So our sun varies about 0.1%. Of the next most stable star we found is like 2-3%. If there was an Earth around that star, which there isn't, all the water would turn to steam, you know, 1 month, and a few months later, all the water would turn to ice. And that's the norm for all these exoplanets that we have found because they have unstable stars. So our star is very, very stable, the most stable object in the universe, I would say, because of the data that we have found. And then, of course, our Earth also very stable because of our atmosphere and our circular orbit. So even though we talk about this variation during the ice ages, compared to other solar systems, other stars, we're very stable. The scientific data also then concludes that we're alone in the universe. When we look out in the universe, we don't see anything like our sun. We don't think anything like our solar system. We don't find anything like our Earth anywhere. Over the last 7,000 years, the Earth has been very, very stable. And then I talked about that before that was a very long and very deep ice age where the planet was covered up to 23% ice. And so I have the last ice age here. Now we're going to zoom in and just look at this last ice age and the age that we're in. And here we are. So here's this last ice age where we had it very cold for a long period of time. And then what normally would have happened, and Hugh has several chapters in his book to describe this, is normally what happened if this deep ice age, the temperature would have gone up and spiked. And when it spiked, it would have then plumbed us into another ice age. And Hugh outlines that some recent scientific discoveries have found that several asteroids hit in three strategic places in our planet, in the Pacific Ocean and in Greenland. And a large ice dam in Canada released lots of cold water into the Atlantic Ocean. And what that did was stop that heat peak, right? So we talked about this on the previous ones. You can see we have these heat peaks here. And that heat peak would immediately then dive into another ice age. And what happened is because of we had these events that that stopped that warming peak, it wound up putting us into this 9,000 years of very stable temperature that we've had. So this temperature stability that we've had is actually very unusual. And of course, this is when advanced civilization took off. And Hugh outlines how advanced civilization really couldn't be impossible previous to this because of the climate instability that the early humans on this Earth had to suffer. We zoom in again, now we look at just the last 2,000 years. A lot of people that discount global warming will point to this medieval warming period, but you can see the medieval warming period isn't anything like the period that we're in currently. So we talked about in this last 100 years, we've had this 1.8 degree temperature Fahrenheit increase, and that doesn't compare to the medieval warming at all. And then, of course, the people that were concerned about heading into an ice age in the 70s were rightfully so because we had a cooling period. So this is just to zoom in more closely on what the more recent temperature of the planet has been. All right, so we know the Earth is warming. And anyone again that tells you that strictly carbon is the problem and so carbon is the solution is wrong. Hugh points then to the Bible, both in Genesis and in Job, the two largest creation texts in the Bible, and say that the Bible's got to give us some win-wins here. And so going back to the Stone Age and turning off all of our fossil fuels isn't the answer, right? Getting rid of our cars isn't going to be the answer. A lot of the quote-unquote solutions that are being put forth in the media and from the scientists aren't solutions at all because they're lose-lose. You know, they're wanting us to ruin our economy, to raise the prices like we are now of gasoline so you can't, you know, poor people can't afford to get to work. And the Bible says there should be some win-wins. There should be some solutions. As the Bible tells us that humanity is supposed to manage the planet not just for humans, but all life on Earth, humans and plants and animals. So the Bible's got to have some win-wins, and if we dig in, there should be some win-win solutions here. And so the last couple chapters of Hugh's book dive into these win-wins that we're going to look into. So the first one, obviously, is fossil fuels. Is fossil fuels the solution to get rid of fossil fuels? This is from me, obviously, out in Hugh's book. I don't know why he didn't. I was astonished to watch the EPA several years ago get testified in front of Congress, and they asked him, obviously, you know, you're trying to do this plan for ending fossil fuels here in the United States. He says, will that end global warming? And the EPA was least honest and replied and said, no, the United States has already cleaned up its air so much since the 1960s that even if we turned off all of our factories and all our cars, the United States cannot change the temperature of the planet. Right? So the problem is not here in the U.S., I can tell you that. Can you help? Yes. Can you solve the problem? Absolutely no. So there needs to be a slow transition. We do have only about 100 to 300 years of fossil fuels left, so we do need to look at alternatives. Do we have to do it drastically right now and ruin our economy? No. Here's the number one problem we have, and hardly anybody is talking about it. The Sahara Desert is twice the size it was 2,000 years ago. I had always wondered that, obviously. I read about the Romans attacking, you know, Carthage and trying to conquer North Africa, and I always wondered, why in the world did they want this place, you know? It's just desert and sand. Why did they, you know, thousands of these soldiers get killed, you know, trying to conquer North Africa? Nobody wants to live there now. Well, that's because 2,000 years ago, North Africa was green, and that was the growing belt. That was the warm place you could grow crops all year round. You had the water flowing down there, and it was just super green and super nice, and so they wanted that for the wheat grain that they grew there 2,000 years ago. The problem is the people around the Sahara Desert and the Gobi Desert are cutting down trees for the last 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years as fuel, and the desert then is growing at an alarming rate. If we do not stop the growth of the Sahara Desert, the savannas will be gone. There'll be no more, you know, animals, lions on the Sahara, on the savannas, because it will be desert. The desert is growing south, and it will head right into the Congo, and nobody is doing anything to stop this. Nobody. And so Hugh puts forward, obviously, a plan, obviously. What we should do is give these people free fuel, give them free kerosene to cook if they promise to stop cutting down trees, and then pay them to plant trees if you really want to save this planet. A win-win, right? These people would obviously be happy to be cooking with modern fuels instead of ashes in their food, and we would stop the growth of the Sahara Desert. And the same thing with China's Gobi Desert is also growing at a very alarming rate. Number one problem for global warming that people aren't talking about, they're not addressing, and they're not fixing. Does it work? Planting trees. Can planting trees actually cool the planet? We absolutely know 100%. When Israel became a nation in 48, they inherited a desert. All the trees, again, have been cutting down for fuel wood, and so they started planting, 240 million trees, and they've turned more than half of Israel back into forest, into green, lush lands. I was telling somebody this, and they're like, well, how can that many trees capture that much carbon? And I'm like, you're not listening to a word I said. I told you carbon is not the problem, right? Trees lower temperature because they give off moisture, and when that moisture makes clouds, makes rain, and then the trees grow more, and they grow out more moisture, and there's more rain, and so you can reclaim a desert not by carbon capturing, but by getting a water cycle going where there's no water cycle. And so we know that reclaiming the desert is very easy to do, just takes the effort to actually do it, manage the trees, and stop people from cutting down new trees. And of course, this also applies. Hugh's talked about this several times from this pulpit, talking about the alarming rate of the Amazon jungle being disappeared, that people are cutting down the trees, just burning the trees, not even selling the trees, just turning it down into farmland, into grazing land. That's going to be a big problem for, again, for global warming, that we really should be putting pressure, not just on Brazil, but the other countries that are occupy the Amazon jungle. And then we need to be managing the forests all around the world better, right? To making sure that obviously our forests are growing and that they're healthy. And then Hugh outlines how selective cutting is the correct answer. We know that here in the United States, we have more forests now than we did 100 years ago, 200 years ago, because we've moved now into selective cutting to cut down the old trees that are a fire hazard, and to get rid of them and make room for more trees that are fast growing and keep the planet cooler. This is one I did not know about, and I was surprised to read in Hugh's book that I didn't find anybody talking about this. So this is one that Hugh came up with. Rice is the number one grain grown around the world, and the problem, obviously, it's grown in mud paddies where you have a lot of dead and decaying vegetation, and so it releases huge amounts of methane gas. And so trying to get people to convert, you know, from rice to other crops and to not have as many of these muddy rice paddies, or at least make sure the rice paddies don't have rotting material in them, would be better. Easy said, these countries have been doing this for thousands of years, be very difficult to implement, but it's definitely something that needs to be on the table as a win-win to come up with another food source. Smart dams. Here in California, we've actually been taking dams down because of environmentalist demands, which is totally ridiculous. They claim, obviously, it blocks the fish migration, but you can build fish ladders around dams, and the dams that have fish ladders, the fish use. You've all seen pictures of fish climbing upstream, and if you give them a little stair that this big, they can jump up it happily, and they'll enjoy doing it. So rather than destroying dams, every dam should have a smart ladder around it for the fish. And so better management of our dams and our water resources needs to be done because it's a wonderful green source of energy to make electricity. So instead of destroying dams, we should be building more smart dams. It's a wonderful green energy source. As the population increases, which it will over the next 40 to 50 years, we need to be using our land more wisely, and so Hugh proposes using multi-level hydroponic farming as a better practice. If you're not familiar with that, the plant is rather than growing in dirt, you just spray the roots with water with nutrients in it, and the plants grow very fast, 3-4 times faster because the roots have more oxygen, and they take up less space. There's less bugs, right, because a bug can't crawl off the ground and get into your plant. So hydroponics, while the initial cost has started as low, the long-term benefits of it has really increased and thinks it really should be increasing use. Meat sources. Hugh's talked about this from this pulpit multiple times, obviously, that cows and lambs and goats are high greenhouse producers. They require a lot of water, a lot of food. Whereas poultry is chicken and ostriches produce a lot less methane gas and use a lot less land. So it's very easy to do, but of course getting people to shift their diet away from red meat to chickens or ostriches is more difficult though. This one is the one that breaks my heart when I talk about it. We had passed the international laws to end whaling years ago, and the whale population is increasing, but now it's kind of leveling off. Norway, Iceland, and Japan still kill thousands of whales per year. Thousands of them. I was just shocked. Japan does it under the disguise of scientific research, and Norway and Iceland just openly kill whales by the thousands, sometimes just for fun, just for sport, why the United States and the international community and the UN doesn't stop these countries from killing these whales is unbelievable. And why do we need whales? Whales fertilize the ocean. And so without healthy oceans, we can't do that. Most of our planet is oceans, and the oceans control the temperature more than land. And so we need these whales to fertilize our oceans. If we can't get the whales to do it, maybe we should fertilize the oceans ourselves. The other one is overfishing. I've known this for years. It's gotten really a hand. The fish are getting smaller and smaller, and some species are going to go extinct very soon. And so a detailed study needs to be done, and we need to try and control these fish that are going extinct. The oceans are so big, we could abuse them for so long. We've been abused them for so long and so much, our oceans are really getting unhealthy. More research needs to be done, and more work needs to be done to protect our oceans. Yeah, this has been in the news recently. Obviously, I wrote this slide before all the flooding in Dubai. It is put forward by a lot of scientists that we can seed clouds to increase cloud cover, and that would cool the planet. And some people say it's risky, especially after happening in Dubai. I don't know what the truth is. I've heard people say that the Dubai flooding was caused by seeding. I've had other scientists say, no, it wasn't caused by flooding. And that's one I actually don't know that what the truth is. I don't know the truth. We don't want to seed over land, though. See, this one here is to do the Pacific Ocean, where there's not few people, and it wouldn't impact people as much. It's a little less risky. Solar roofs. Home solar roofs are a good thing. Putting solar panels in the desert is a bad thing. So how can that be? How can it be good in one place and bad in another place? Well, here in Los Angeles, if you're putting a solar panel in, because we have a lot of plants, a lot of streets, there's not a lot of dust. My uncle worked for Edison his whole life, and he would joke and say we have these solar plants out in the desert, and they make electricity. The problem is they don't make a dime of money. They're all subsidized by natural gas. And why? Because the little bit of breeze out in the desert, and guess what? Solar panels covered with dust. They don't have any automatic cleaning system, so they actually have people out there, even in the summer, in the sun, cleaning those solar panels. The first one they built had mirrors on a gimbal, and dirt would get into the gimbal, and so they had to constantly go out there and clean and re-grease them or whatever, just a complete waste of money. Made electricity, but not a dime. And there's no water out there, so you got to actually pipe the water or truck the water out to clean up these solar panels out there also. So putting solar panels in the desert has just not been a good option. Putting them on your home where you can clean them and keep an eye on them is a wonderful solution for making green energy. But we got to stop putting them out in the desert. This is one I did not know about either, obviously. So I knew that bitcoins is very volatile. It's basically like gambling. Some people win a lot. Some people lose a lot. What I didn't realize, obviously, is it uses up tons and tons of energy. This is banks and banks of computers to keep track of bitcoins. And so the computers use lots of energy, and of course they produce lots of heat, so you have this huge air conditioners on the roof to keep them cool so that a few people can gamble and keep money. So who just thinks, obviously, Congress has just passed a law and just outright ban it? It's just a waste of time, money, energy to invest in gambling, and it's heating up our cities. Some high-tech solutions. So this one was a really early proposal put forward. If you really wanted to cool the planet, we'd rather than ending fossil fuels and putting people into the Stone Age and raising the cost of living for people and hurting poor people, you could put a satellite up there. It would unfurl a shade that could cool, say, any place, obviously. It puts a Lagrange point, obviously. You could just, a lot of the ocean's heat all comes from the Gulf Coast. I mean, if you're aware of that, obviously, the Gulf of Mexico is what keeps England warm. And if England's getting too hot, you could just cool down the Gulf Coast and cool it. Other people have also proposed putting a lens up there, diffuse the light source a little bit. And again, these are adjustable. So, if you don't like it, you can just reposition the satellite or close up the shade and cool the planet. And so there are very low-cost simple solutions that are reversible. These ones are reversible to cool the planet rather than ending fossil fuels immediately and putting us into the Stone Age. All right, not in Hugh's book. So I have things, that obviously, that I've read about and I studied out before Hugh even came out with his book. I'm also departing now. Hugh, as you know, is much nicer and kinder than I am, and I'm more blunt and honest. Everybody that knows that. So I'm going to get into more of the political realm, obviously, and some of the details that aren't in Hugh's book. The very first one I'm surprised wasn't in Hugh's book, obviously. There was a survey done that if every major city in the United States changed their commercial buildings to white roofs, they could cool the planet, by a half a degree. So the big problem we have with global warming is not just cutting down trees and increasing carbon and methane. The problem is we have bigger and bigger cities, and these cities typically have lots of asphalt and lots of dark roofs. My neighbor's got a black roof, and his house is hotter than mine. His neighbor, the whole thing around his house is hotter than mine because he's got a black roof. And that produces heat. And so the heat that we're concentrating is a lot in cities. Here in LA County, commercial buildings now actually have to have white roofs. Any flat roof has to be white. If we increase the more concrete, less asphalt. If we made the cities more reflective, it would cool the cities and would also cool the planets. Not in Hugh's book, and I'm not surprised why that it's not there, because this has been proven in a very simple solution. Geothermal is not in Hugh's book, and one of the reasons he didn't put it in there is it's a limited location. A lot of people tell me and sit there and say, oh, look at Iceland gets 80% of their electricity from geothermal, where you just pump water into the ground, you let the magma heat the water, it comes out as free steam and makes electricity. California actually makes more geothermal electricity than Iceland. People just don't know that. So in the Owens Valley, like around Mammoth, the lava is almost up to the surface now. You can pump water down just a few hundred feet, and you have free energy to boil that water. We haven't built more because of the drought. It does require water, and a lot of the Owens Valley water comes to Los Angeles, and the water aqueduct. But anyways, all around the Ring of Fire, these things could be built. Why people aren't building more of them, I don't know. They work great. It's wonderful free energy. Just requires water. That's it. And the Ring of Fire. Although I doubt I'm going to get anybody to build one in Yellowstone. Wind is not in Hugh's book because it's a lose-lose. The bigger problem with that is not in my backyard. So one of the windiest places in the United States is the is Cape Cod, and they wanted to build these all along Cape Cod, but who lives in Cape Cod? All the rich politicians live along there, rich people, and they said, I love wind, but not in my backyard. And so so they're very limited location. Any place that we could build them, we have built them. They're not going to be more built. Nobody wants them, and they are killing a lot of our birds, you know, especially birds of prey. So it's not a solution for anything. This one's not going to be a solution either. There's enough energy going underneath the Golden Gate Bridge every day to power the whole United States, our whole California. But nobody's going to let us put a turbine under Golden Gate Bridge. So a couple countries have done some of these. These are two prototypes that are working in France and Canada. And as the current moves in and out, it will turn a turbine and make electricity. The problem is it's very costly. Salt water is very corrosive. We have to make these out of metal, so they rust away very quickly. So they're very expensive to make. And, you know, they're working, but they're not making any money, right? So they're not a solution. Nuclear power. This is not in Hugh's book either, and he didn't explain why. And that's mostly, as I was surprised, we only have about 100 years of nuclear power left. So when Hillary Clinton sold 20% of our nuclear power to Russia, that was a big problem because that actually just decreased our use of nuclear energy by 20 years, right? So currently, United States, 20% of our electricity comes from nuclear energy, which is a completely clean source. Globally, it's 10%. Here in California, it's 9 to 10%. We have two new reactors still left at Diablo Canyon. The state of California passed a law to close these immediately, and as soon as they signed the law, the governor came back and said, well, wait a second, you know, we'll have to have rolling blackouts for every California for an hour once a week because that's 10% of our energy source, and we have nothing to replace it. And so now the governor is saying, let's turn it off in 10 years instead of right now. So nuclear power is a very emotional event, and that's mostly because of Chernobyl. Chernobyl didn't put these concrete domes over their reactor, and so the radiation released. Three Mile Island proved that these reactors are safe, and that Three Mile Island, we had nuclear waste spill on the floor of these vehicles, on these buildings, and absolutely nothing released into the atmosphere. Because if you build them correctly, they don't. In Japan, the tsunami broke one of the pipes and a little radioactive material released. That radioactivity that released is less than living in Colorado. There's more radiation living in Colorado on granite rocks than what came out of Japan. Our meters are just so insensitive now. So there's a lot of emotion about this. The biggest damage for nuclear power, of course, was the China Syndrome movie, which was totally fiction. Now, this one I love. I've had people that tell me, I drive an electric vehicle. It's emission-free, and I'm saving the planet. And anybody that's told me that regrets it, because I tell them, no, you don't. Your car's dirtier than my car, and I drive a 20-year-old gas car. It's like, how could that be? I says, well, there's no natural source of electricity. Are you harnessing lightning bolts? No. Do you have solar panels on your roof to charge your battery while you sleep? No. It's like, well, electric cars here in California, this is what they run on. They run on natural gas, petroleum, nuclear, and then a little bit of renewables, about 12%. And so 90% of electric vehicles are putting out dirty pollution, you know, more than my car is, right? If you got an electric car back east, you're still using coal to pull your car. And you can actually see that in places where they have diesel generators to make electricity to charge electric cars. Right? So electric cars are not the answer. A battery is nothing but an expensive gas tank. The car in my gas tank cost about $300. A Tesla gas tank costs $10,000, but they're still both empty gas tanks that you must fill. Right? So batteries are not a source of electricity. Right? So electric batteries are not the answer. These are other things that are, we just talked about. Batteries are not the answer. Electric cars aren't the answer. Hydrogen cars, wonderful, just puts out water out of your tailpipe. You could feel so good about yourself. There's no natural source of hydrogen. Hydrogen is made by superheating natural gas, which makes more pollution than it was if you had a natural gas car. Hydrogen car is not the answer. Hybrids, you get a little better gas mileage. It's not going to save the planet. Anybody driving a hybrid car thinks they're saving the planet, you know, I don't want to go there. High taxes, I don't know, understand how that's going to solve the problem. High fuel costs, like we're doing now, is just making people poor. Poor people are suffering. It's not the solution. Destroying the U.S. economy is not the solution. carbon offsets. This is great. You can ship by UPS and click a little box that says carbon offset. A survey was done last year to find out where these millions of dollars that were collected were going on that little checkbox. It's supposed to go to plant trees. They found 10% of the money went to plant trees and 90% of it went to lobbyists, lawyers, and who knows what else. A lot of the green money just disappears. It doesn't go anywhere, if you probably know that. So these aren't in whose box because they're just not politically correct. But I don't worry about that. All right, question time. You got to go to the mic.
Thank you,
There's
Dave.
Nobody there, so head back there, Al.
Anybody here wants to ask a question?
Can be on climate change. Last week I taught archaeology, or the week before that was birds or animals. I could take any question Hugh would take almost.
Any question?
Except for where did I park my car? I asked Hugh what the most difficult question he ever asked was, and he said, where did you park your car? Because it was a big parking lot, he couldn't remember. And he said that was the most difficult question he was asked.
Well, I'm gonna start with a question myself, and then we'll go to some online questions. It looks like we've got a few people here. I know a lot of Christian friends who see climate change and this whole issue, they kind of see it as a liberal issue. And yet, saving the planet, preserving the planet, is a mandate in Genesis. So can you just comment on that sort of tension? How do we talk to Christians about this issue?
Yeah, well, by quoting those verses in Genesis 1 and Job that tell us that we should be good stewards and manage this planet, that's why God put us here, was to manage the animals, manage the plant, you know. I mean, that what was first command to Adam was, you know, name the planets, count them. Name and count them. Know what your environment is so you could take care of them. And so it is a totally Christian thing to do that. And unfortunately, a lot of environmentalism, as you just said, has been hijacked by people more on the left spectrum, obviously, that use it as a political tool. And so Hugh really is the voice crying in the wilderness. You know, it's really heartbreaking for me to hear the news and realize that everybody's not telling me the truth. You know, that getting rid of fossil fuels is going to save the planet is not true. And then you have people on the other side saying it's a total myth and it's nothing we should be concerned at all. And he was the one saying, only one I've heard in the middle saying, no, it's real, and we have to have biblical solutions, which are win-win solutions that Hugh put forth and that I added a few more to. And so we need to, not poo-poo environmentalism. We need to say that environmentalism needs to benefit humans also. We're part of this environment, and putting us back to the Stone Age and doubling the price of gasoline so poor people are suffering and can't get to work or can't feed their children is not the solution. You know, God is going to give us solutions that are win-wins, you know. And shrinking the Sahara Desert would be the first things you talk about, because that's something people could understand, right? Why did the Romans, you know, conquer North Africa? I mean, that's a real simple one to ask people, and I've done that. Why were they just desert? It was because 2,000 years ago it wasn't. The Sahara Desert is growing way too fast, and it's something that everybody on the left and the right should be concerned about and want to come up with a solution to help these people in Africa, right? I'm telling people in Africa, don't cook your food. I'm saying let's give them free fuel and ask them to plant trees in return.
Good, thank you. So Val Durham says, a controversial attempt to control expansion of the Sahara Desert is the, quote, Great Green Wall. It consists of planting desert trees over an 8,000-kilometer line on the southern border. Are you familiar with this, and do you think it will be effective?
It will be if everybody gets behind it. Right now, there are plans. So there are plans to shrink the Sahara Desert. It's just a plan at the moment. There's just not a lot of action going on there, right? So that plan needs to be put in place and to be funded. The UN needs to be involved. We need other people involved, you know, to help these people on a global level.
Questioners go.
Yeah, while they're doing that, the other one I didn't have a slide for it. I didn't put on there, obviously, and Hugh doesn't address it either. He talks a little bit about it. He has a chapter that's called the Selfish Gene. And so the bigger problem, Hugh's even done this to talk with young people, saying, you don't think global warming's real? Yes, you know. Do you think we should do something? Yes. Are all of you willing to, you know, to live in the Stone Age, you know, and you know, give up your high life technology, you know, for that. And I'm like, well, no, I think the older generations should do that, you know. They're the one that caused the problem. And China is a big problem at the moment. China every week is putting on a brand new dirty coal power plant. And if you, and I really feel for the people of Japan, I thought our environment here in Los Angeles was bad. In the 60s, your eyes would burn in the summer because our air was so bad. In China, people are dying every single day because their air is so bad and China doesn't care. And they're building these dirty coal plants, you know, to up the middle class in China. And so their standard of living is going up, but their life expectancy is going down. They're having to wear masks and respirators in the city when the smog is really bad. And so China, unfortunately, is a big part of the problem.
Hi, I'm Al Morris. Back to the Sahara Desert. Yeah, back to the Sahara Desert issue. How long would it take, assuming everything was perfect and everybody was supporting whatever efforts? It seems like you have to have massive pipes drawing water from other sources, pumps going on, and a lot of that. I know that the Israelis have been very successful, but how long is it anticipated that if ideally everybody worked together, how long would it take?
What we saw here from Israel was, 60, 80 years to do it? So it is doable in a lifetime. The way that Israel does it, so we actually have the answer for that, it does rain in the Sahara, and it actually snows in the Sahara occasionally, but just very not often. Israel didn't have the water either. They didn't have a desalination plant, you know, the rivers they needed for people. So what you do is you build a big pit that's maybe 20 feet in diameter, and you plant the tree in the bottom of the pit so that what water does rain funnels to that tree. And then as you get more water, then of course you can start planting a tree in a dip between those two trees, and that's what Israel did, to the point where now you have enough water cycle, enough rain, that you don't need these pits at all. So we have the answer on how Israel did it. They were very clever. Again, they're reading their Bible, and they have that answer. It could be done in 60 years, and Israel has already given us the solution on how to do it, and we should follow them, you know. But, of course, some people don't like that because they don't want any answers out of Israel, unfortunately, you know. So we have all these emotional problems in the way on climate change. Go ahead, Al.
Yeah, just one last thing. There's water collectors that you can get water from the air that they use. Is that a realistic solution, or is that just a happenstance?
Some places that have fog. So you're referring to Peru and Chile, and what they do is have large nets that collect the fog, and the fog turns it into water, and they got that from plants. It doesn't rain very often in Chile or Peru at all. And what they've done is notice that the dew would collect on the plants, and then the plants would obviously convert that, condensate that, and run down to its base for its roots. And so based on what the plants were doing, they now actually have too many people, so they put these huge nets that every morning when the fog rolls in, they get that. That's not going to work in the Sahara Desert because you just don't get a fog, but it's a great solution for Chile and Peru.
Mm-hmm. Dave, Robert Gibson says, how does the duck curve on California's electrical grid, which is caused by solar power, how does it affect the reliability of our electrical grid? Are you familiar with that term?
Would you say duck? I haven't heard the
duck curve.
The duck curve. Nah, I haven't heard of that. I can talk. I've studied a lot of California. I can give you a quick history of California. So California has been very environmental, you know, conscious for a long time. I've talked about that they've taken dams down, so we have less electricity from dams. They have not built a single new power plant in California for some 20, 30 years. We had two nuclear power plants down, in San Onofre. Ones they put those offline once they had problems with the tubes. They could have been used for another 50, 60 years, but that was political to shut them down. So what we currently do now is we actually buy electricity from Arizona, Nevada, and even Texas. They're burning oil in Texas and shipping it all the way here to Los Angeles for us because we don't have enough electricity because we haven't built power plants. The power plants that we have, obviously, are ones that were like, say, oil here in Pasadena. They had oil-fired power plants. They shut those down and put in gas turbine jets. So California used to export natural gas. We are finally now importing natural gas because we have these huge jet engines. You just take a jet engine, feed it natural gas, hook it up to a generator, and that's how we're making our electricity. In the past, those were only used for afternoon peak power because it's the most expensive way to generate electricity, which is why electricity is more expensive in California than the other 50 states. And even those gas turbines aren't enough. We, as you know, obviously we have rolling blackouts in the summer when we don't have enough power. And that's because, likewise, Texas is going to keep their power for themselves. They're not going to ship it to us just because California needs it. So we turn off our electricity. If we turn off San Onofre, Diablo Canyon, which makes 10% electricity, then every single California will have rolling blackouts probably once a week because that'd be 10% of our energy gone. So California, yeah, it's a problem. It's a problem. We have high expensive electricity, and it's only bound to go up because we're not coming up with any smart solutions to replace it.
Another question from Robert Gibson. He says, could we use thorium as a fuel for nuclear reactors?
That actually, Hugh actually talked about that, obviously. Plutonium and thorium are good substitutes for uranium since uranium levels are getting low. Hugh proposes, obviously, using thorium and plutonium as replacement sources, and that could keep nuclear power plants going, you know, for a few more hundred years. So that actually is a solution, and it actually is in Hugh's book, and he's talked about that.
Steve, have you heard of, I believe it's John Sawyer. He was an African politician who was a major landowner, and he's promoted regenerative agriculture. And it's based on herds of wild animals moving through the wilderness, and they naturally fertilize and turn the soil. And they've applied it to, I guess he came to Colorado and promoted it here. Have you heard of that?
No, I have not heard about that, no.
Apparently it turns drier areas greener.
Yeah. Well, just as we talk about whales fertilize the ocean, definitely our herbivores fertilize our land mass, obviously. But the problem, obviously, the herbivores, obviously, large herbivores like that, is not only do they fertilize land, but they also trample it. They make trails, you know, where the plants can't grow. And so they're not a complete solution. The herbivores also, you know, make methane gas, which is why they're trying to, you know, regulate them. And so the large reveals, Hugh would say, are not really a solution, that they really actually are part of the problem. Although if we implemented these other things that we talked about, we could keep our large herbivores, you know, our cows.
Doug McComb is asking a question. Can you please explain the difference between climate and weather, and how does that relate to this discussion?
Yeah, very good. Weather is a scientist would define as a local area. So we ask, what's the weather going to be tomorrow? We're talking about, what is it going to be like here in Los Angeles? Is it going to be sunny? Is it going to be rain? We talk about climate, we're talking about a much larger span and the entire globe. And so we average this. And it's a good thing he asked that question, because in Hugh's book it talked about that one of the reasons that some people are skeptical about the warming of the planet is that some parts are warming and some parts are cooling. And so in order to come to this 1.8 degree increase over the last year, you have to average everything out. Some people in Canada, obviously, that's getting warmer in Canada, and if you lived in Canada, you'd be a little bit happy about that. So in Canada, there's a big debate. They're like, we love warming. We got the short end of the stick getting all this tundra, you know, up here. And so if some tundra turns into trees and grassland, good for us, you know, where other parts of the country, world, obviously, are getting a little bit cooler. And that's the other reason they've gone to this climate change discussion, not just global warming, because if you lived in some place that's getting a little bit cooler, then you would be skeptical, right? So part of it, that change in terminology, was because of these regional differences, and part of it, obviously, because a lot of these predictions, like Al Gore made, that by now the planet should be in complete disaster, just didn't come true. So we definitely have some alarmists, and those alarmists, like Al Gore, hurt their cause. So the planet is warming, but a lot of people will discount it because Al Gore and other people are these alarmists just saying, you know, gloom and doom if we don't, you know, immediately shut off all of our power plants and go back to the Stone Age tomorrow, you know.
SlamRN asks, I think I heard that China was going to build thorium salt reactors. Do you know if this is true, and would it be a good way to go?
China is very interesting. What China's been doing for PR is, I told you, they're building a new power plant every single week in China and polluting their country. And so they're finally getting political pressure because of their environmental record being just so absolutely appalling. And so there's lots of proposals in China. They claim they're going to go solar, they're going to go green energy, they're going to go wind, they're going to go nuclear. They have lots of proposals. But it's all because we're talking about the Chinese government, you can't believe a single thing they say, because the proof is in the pudding that they're actually doing absolutely nothing. And so that is a proposal. That is a real proposal, what they're talking about. Will China actually build those and put them online? Probably not. Are they a solution? They definitely should be on the table.
Hello again. Hi. Just had a question about landfills. How, with all the waste that we generate and everything, how are they dealing with it, and how much of a factor is that in the overall picture that you're talking about?
Yeah, that is a green energy source, and it actually is being captured. One of the reasons you can keep your food crops low, obviously, is these people that have these dairy farms get lots of manure, and that manure will rot and make lots of methane gas. And so some places they were doing it before it was even mandated by law. Some is by law now. Like here in California, if you have a landfill, you have to put a big plastic cover over it and peak it. And at the very top, you can collect methane gas and use that to power generators. And farmers have been doing that now for quite a while, probably for the last 50, 60 years. If they got manure, they look at that and they actually can be self-sufficient. So there's some farmers that get enough methane gas from their manure to power, you know, their house and their farm equipment and processing machines. They're totally sufficient. They can totally be off grid. Biomass deposits of landfills and animals makes lots of methane gas, and it's great that's being captured instead of going to the atmosphere, being burned and used as a fuel source. Is that a solution? No, because we're talking about 0.02% of our energy. But it is being done, but it's not a solution.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
What about city waste?
Yeah, the city waste, that is also. So we have our landfill. If you're here in Sierra Madre, here in Pasadena, your waste right now, if you see those trucks when you're going down the 134 freeway is going into Shoal Canyon above Glendale. And some of that has been completed, obviously, where they have plastic over there and they're getting methane gas and they're using that to make electricity. One of those quit making methane gas. It finally rotted enough, and they actually put dirt over it and put a golf course on top of it. And the one that's still being filled, obviously, isn't ready to be capped. But once it's full, we put the plastic over, step capturing that. So, yes, we do that for residential waste also, not just farm waste.
Dave, Tinny W. has a question. I think I understand it. Let's see. She says, for EVs and hybrids, wouldn't the net carbon use still be lower, since you wouldn't have to use as much gas tank carriers to fill gas stations that have to run on gas and diesel?
No. Hugh has talked about this. I've talked about it before. Electric vehicles pollute more than gasoline cars. And the reason is what do we make those big gas tanks out of, electric batteries, we call them? Batteries, we make them out of lithium. And what is lithium? Lithium is a rare earth metal. So to make my car, they had to mine maybe a room, the third of this room, right, to get the metal to make my car, to make my gas tank. To make one electric battery, obviously, for an electric vehicle, you would have to mine something the size of this whole church just to get enough lithium to make one battery. What's mining all that dirt? Huge diesel trucks, earth movers. So the recent study came out that if you get an electric vehicle, you have to drive it 60,000 miles within the first 5 years for it to break even on carbon, just to break even, And the problem, obviously, is these lithium batteries have a life of 8 to 10 years. So electric cars pollute more than gas cars. You just can't get around it because they're more costly to manufacture. And then when you get done, you have to recycle that battery, which again takes more energy. So unfortunately, electric vehicles and batteries are not a solution. They're actually part of the problem.
Well, Dave, it looks like everyone is completely fully educated on this subject.
Well, that's pretty, for being a controversial subject, this is pretty good. I was expecting a little bit more questions or feedback or heat to my feet or whatever, because this has got to be the most controversial topic out there, obviously, to talk about, because people get so heated about it, obviously. And maybe you could take this book to your Thanksgiving dinner, you know, instead of bringing it up. You can say, I was reading, it was very interesting, you know, and hand these out, right? Hugh would like that, obviously. And it would help help the planet, obviously, you know. Give this to gift to people, you know. If you want to save the planet, I'm going to practical way to save the planet and stuff. Instead of buying an electric vehicle, this book is a lot less expensive than an electric vehicle, a lot cheaper. Buy this and give it to all your friends and relatives and just say, I'm concerned about the planet. Are you? How could they argue with that, right? 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 I'm a Christian. I'm concerned about this planet, and we need to do something. What do you think about the Sahara Desert? What do you think about the Gobi Desert? You know? And give them this book, and we could actually, Christians can make a difference if they got out there. But at the moment, Hugh, unfortunately, is the voice crying out in the wilderness, and we need to make him not in the wilderness and make him a common word. And his solution is a common word. It's a win-win solution from a Christian perspective.
Well, after I said that, Dave, we got two more questions, so you're still going to be up there.
Yes.
Okay.
Hi, Dave. I appreciate your doing this overview of Hugh's book, because it's kind of a big topic. I read it a couple of years ago, and it's nice to have a refresher on that. There is one thing that's kind of, I know because of time, you're trying to cover a lot of ground, but kind of I felt like they were just touching high points on a lot of things, and there's a lot more subtlety that goes into any one of your arguments. Obviously, you know that.
Give it to people.
One thing that's been on my mind for many years, really, is this white roof, black roof, white asphalt, black asphalt question that you just kind of gloss over. Black absorbs the heat, and so that's bad, and white reflects it. But black is basically a black body radiator, so it's very efficient at radiating heat as well as absorbing direct sunlight. And so there's going to be times of the day where it's absorbing the sunlight, and other times where it's radiating it away. And so I'm thinking there's a balance here, and I don't really know how to evaluate what the difference is there. Likewise with the white surfaces, white is white in the visible spectrum, but there's a lot of different kinds of white coatings, some of which have very bad characteristics in the ultraviolet or the infrared. And for example, if you're looking at putting a white coating on your roof, there's no good way of evaluating from the information available which kinds of coatings are better. I considered putting a white roof on my house a couple of years ago, and I could look at the reflectance and absorptivity and whatnot characteristics that were shown on the sales brochures, and there's barely any difference between the white and, say, the browns and that sort of thing. And so I'm kind of left, and I'm sure other people left, kind of a questioning as to really how much benefit that is. Do you have any comments at all on those topics?
I do. I mean, we have absolute scientific data that the cities and around the world are getting hotter, right? I mean, it's not just the black asphalt, the black roofs, but because of our cars, our air conditioners, you know, we're making the environment warmer. As far as the brown and white, you're 100% true. If you go to my house, I put a roof on recently, obviously, so the back of my house is flat, and by county law, I had to put white roll roofing on the back of that house. I didn't want white on the front for aesthetics, because mine's kind of a ranch-style house, and so I put a light brown on the front, and you're correct. If I was to measure the temperature of my light brown versus my white, you know, there's not a big difference. So that what you said there is 100% true. But to say, obviously, it's not going to make a difference is just not true. So with city neighborhoods that have been designed more with these lighter colors, where they've mandated the roads be concrete, you know, or some other light material rather than asphalt, they've measured those neighborhoods and noticed that they are cooler. And so reactivity is a very important thing, obviously. Yeah, I have a friend in Arizona, and he just bought a black van, and he was just surprised, obviously, that all the paneling and everything, the vinyl in the front, was all deteriorated after 1 year. And I'm like, you live in Arizona where the summers, you know, are over 100 degrees, and you bought a black car, you know? It's like, why wouldn't you buy a white one? I like the look. And I'm like, well, that's great, but obviously black absorbs heat. That's why I had water solar panels to heat my pool for years. Those are what? Black, because it got very hot, right? You know, and I have those, you put those on my roof, obviously, right? The light part, the black part, and the temperature difference is huge. My solar panels worked so good on my back of my house. I had a jacuzzi, and if I turned my panels on by noon, I could have my jacuzzi to 120 degrees by 3 o'clock. And of course, water takes a long time to heat up, so I could even enjoy it in the evening. So the difference between black and white, as far as temperature difference, is astronomical, and we know our cities are getting warm. And so we know that if we get more and more, if we get more cities to buy into this, obviously, of getting more reflective material, we could cool the cities. It would make a big difference, not just for the climate, but just for the people that live in those environments.
David,
hi.
So you invited controversial topics.
I did.
Couldn't
I
resist.
I took on the big
I
one.
I just heard one this week that it seemed out of left field, so maybe you've heard about it. But first, about the color of roofs and things. Tim's point is important, that we can't oversimplify things, like things that are shiny and reflective are cooler and darker and black or hotter. If you've ever left a chrome wrench out in the sun, oh boy, does it get hot,
it gets
right?
Very hot, yes.
And that's a shiny chrome wrench. All right, so this week I read, I'm not sure if it was Australian physicist, scientist that published this, but they said, you've got it all wrong about CO2. And I wonder if you'd seen this report. It's like CO2 is not that big a contribution. And this, I know there are all kinds of fringe people making these claims, but this seemed like a really credible report. And I wonder if you'd heard about that.
Yeah, he's not the only one that does that, obviously. You probably weren't here at the opening. Were you opening when I told you, obviously, when I talk to people and immediately they just go to carbon, I know they haven't read on the subject. And I immediately just sit there and say, to have a dialogue, you first have to understand global temperature, you know? And so anyone that just says carbon equals temperature is wrong. And so I had a slide in here to talk about ocean currents, you know, cloud cover, trees, you know, everything. Even, like I said, even ants and viruses are part of, major contributors to the temperature of the planet. And so some scientists now are getting on that and realizing that this focus on carbon is not the solution to the problem. And raising the price of fossil fuels or trying to limit fossil fuels immediately is not going to be the solution. If we don't address the Sahara Desert, you know, then we could turn off all of our power plants and all our cars tomorrow, and it's not going to solve our problem if we don't address the Gobi Desert. And so if we don't address some of these large problems that we have, it's going to be a serious problem. I mean, if you think about that, the Sahara Desert right now is projected, you know, in the next 100 years to eliminate the savannas, and then it will start heading into the Congo, you know, and the Amazon jungle. The rate that it's being destroyed right now, if that's not addressed, obviously the same thing's going to happen in South America. Instead of being the coolest spot and producing the most rain and the most cooling effect, we'll have another desert in South America, and those will just devastate this planet. We can't survive that. You just can't recover from those. The Sahara Desert and the Amazon and the Gobi Desert. If those three things aren't addressed, all this other stuff is just peripheral.
Robert McIntosh says, I haven't seen anyone touch on the cost of getting the electricity to electric vehicles. It's usually quite a bit more expensive to burn coal somewhere else and then run the generators. Can you comment on that?
I most certainly can. Yeah, you're right in my subject. I'm an electronic engineer, and you're correct. Every time we put electricity through a transformer, we lose 10% of the energy. So you can imagine, obviously, that if you've got a power plant in Texas burning oil, it's gone through several transformers to get to us, and so you could have lost easily at the minimum of 20% of the energy to get it from Texas to here if you only went through two transformers. But, of course, there's another transformer to step it down to get it to lines that go down your street, which is around 20,000 volts, and then you have to have another transformer. You've seen those on the poles in your backyard or in underground to get it so it goes to another one. So you've got going through at least, you could lose half your energy coming here from Texas easily. So you're burning oil in Texas to charge your electric vehicle, and half of it's all gone to the transformers to get it here. So he is absolutely correct, obviously. And that's another reason why electric vehicles and batteries are not the solution. It's highly inefficient.
And transformers lose their energy through heat.
Heat, right. So we're heating up the planet to get it here, correct,
right.
Also. Yes, you're 100% correct. Yep. Anybody that's got one of those transformers, they actually are cooled by oil to keep them cool. They have the big ones have radiators on them, and then the smaller ones just heat through the metal shield. And so you're correct, we lose a lot of electricity transforming these electricity over long distances. So electric vehicles are just, they're not a solution. Like I said, they're hurting the planet. They're actually detrimental.
Thank you, Dave. Would you close us in prayer?
Thank you. Dear Lord, we do thank you that you have given us win-wins. We thank you for the wisdom that we find in the Bible, not only about our relationships to one another, how important love and forgiveness is, especially the forgiveness that you offer us through your Son, Jesus Christ, but that you offer solutions also to every common day problems, like dealing with our environment. We do pray that Christians would take the mantle of environmentalism and bring forth truth, your truth, from the Bible, from nature. You told us to look at the animals, to look at the plants, to look at this planet, and it would teach us, Lord. Help us to see what the planet is teaching us so that we may be good stewards of our planet. May the emotions go down, may the politics go down, may the money go down, and may truth prevail because we know that you are the ultimate truth. Amen.